and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kbu.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Now that there is at least an official ceasefire in Gaza, many observers have noticed that Israel appears to be turning its attention more and more toward the West Bank. Secretary of State Marco Rubio recently lifted sanctions that had been imposed on violent West Bank Israeli settlers. And Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has said that Israel is a step away from annexing the Palestinian territory. Anel Shaleen is a research fellow for the Middle East at the Quincy Institute, who resigned from the State Department over what she called former President Biden's unconscionable Gaza policy. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Let me first ask you, when you did resign over the Gaza policy, what was the reaction from your colleagues?
It was interesting because I had left, I had emailed several colleagues just letting them know I was resigning over Gaza and had given them a personal email address where they could reach me if they so desired, since obviously my State Department email address was not going to work anymore. And several colleagues did reach out to express their support and their gratitude. That ended fairly quickly. I assume, and my understanding from friends is the message from higher up was clear that what I had done was inappropriate, and the State Department does not condone people going public. You know, public resignations are not sort of in the mode of the State Department, where you have access to this classified information and you also have the dissent channel. And so the idea is that you should express your dissent internally and that it's out of keeping with the character of someone serving in the State Department to sort of go public and splash something like this across the headlines.
And so there was some internal discussion before you left, right? Not just from yourself, but from others, would you say?
Oh, certainly. I was part of very active groups within State Department. Many of us were just connected over Signal threads. These were not necessarily people who were in person communicating, but there was a significant amount of distress and shock at what the Biden administration was facilitating and supporting and directly enabling. And, you know, I had made it known that I was going to be resigning in protest, but I hadn't initially planned to go public with the resignation. I hadn't been at the State Department for very long, and I didn't think that anyone would care that I was opposed to this policy. But it was colleagues at State who said, please go public with your resignation. And so I decided I would. And it did end up getting more attention than I would have expected.
I guess along with all the other resignations from the State Department and the UN for that matter.
Well, yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, the very first resignation was Josh Paul, who resigned within weeks of October 7th, who I very much commend. And I had been in touch with Josh before I resigned, just letting him know that I was also going to be resigning. And at the time that I resigned, there were three of us. So it was Josh and then Tarek Habash, who is Palestinian American, who resigned from the Department of Education. And then I resigned. And then following that, you saw several additional people resigning publicly, but many others have also resigned privately. They haven't necessarily gone public with it, but they have decided they could no longer be part of what the government was doing.
Did you get the impression that the higher-ups in the U.S. government are actually in favor of what the Israelis are doing or have done, and that they feel compelled to make public statements suggesting otherwise, that they're concerned about the humanitarian crisis, but really they do like the idea of the Israelis clearing out Gaza, so to speak?
I think it depends who we're speaking of. Obviously, the U.S. government is vast, and there are many people in senior positions who may have privately disagreed, but did not go so far as to speak out against it. But I do think, obviously, it's clear that those who were in the direct decision-making role on this policy, so people from the National Security Council, in particular people like Brett McGurk or Jake Sullivan, Amos Hochstein, and obviously President Biden himself, were all supportive. And what's been interesting is to observe in the past few weeks, in the waning days of the Biden administration, as you had several of these officials try to portray what they had done in a positive light, and often receiving some pushback that their legacy will be genocide. And instead, they're trying to make the argument that this has been to U.S. benefit, that the reduction in the strength of Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran is all something that the U.S. should celebrate. I think, contrary to that, the real effect has been an extreme undermining of the U.S. leadership on the global stage, and any pretension the U.S. had to uphold international law or to be an advocate for human rights or to try to hold other countries accountable on concerns of international law or human rights has been completely destroyed. And so in the longer run, I do think that the level of damage done to America's reputation and the way other countries view America is far more significant than any sort of nominal reduction in the numbers of Hamas, given in particular that Blinken himself acknowledged that recruitment for Hamas is higher now than before October 7th. So their narrative that this has somehow made sort of advance U.S. interests in the region, I think is truly flawed, given the level of instability we've observed, given the way that the U.S. has had to bulk up its force posture in the Middle East at a time when many security experts are arguing that the Middle East really is not such a crucial arena or region for the U.S. to focus so many resources or so much attention on. You know, I think these are our officials trying to launder their legacy, and I don't think they'll be successful in the long run.
So now we're in the ceasefire phase in Gaza, or so-called ceasefire. And do you think that there was a kind of a deal made when Trump came in that he was communicating with the Israeli leaders and saying that, okay, we could have this ceasefire, but you could do whatever you want in the West Bank? And besides, the ceasefire may not last?
I mean, that certainly seems to be how Netanyahu and his cohort have taken that. I don't know what I'm hearing from certain people who may or may not have good information here is that Trump did not necessarily explicitly make any sort of quid pro quo, you know, accept a ceasefire in Gaza, but you have open season in the West Bank. They're saying that it's not what he said, but it's regardless of what he said, it seems quite clear that that is how the Israeli government took it. And I do worry very much that from the perspective of the extreme right wing exemplified by Netanyahu's government, that the West Bank is a bigger priority for them anyway. And what's especially alarming is that you hear U.S. officials echoing these extreme right-wing talking points, people from Senator Tom Cotton referring to Judea and Samaria, to use sort of Israel's preferred word for the words for the West Bank. But even people like former President Bill Clinton used the words Judea and Samaria to refer to the West Bank. And this was obviously the president responsible for the Oslo Accords and this ostensible pathway towards a future Palestinian state, which I think just makes clear how deceptive Oslo was all along, since clearly the United States did not use any pressure to actually ensure that Israel pushed forwards towards the establishment of a Palestinian state. So I do worry that the ceasefire is not likely to last in Gaza, and that you now have the transfer of a lot of Israel's attention to this increased level of violence and displacement in the West Bank.
Yeah, it does seem like Israeli officials, or some of them, have made clear that even if they allow the ceasefire to go on for as long as it's supposed to, they'd like to resume the war. And I don't know what Trump's reaction to that would be, but he sometimes refers to, we have to end these stupid wars, whether he's talking about Ukraine or Israel, Gaza. And so you wonder whether he'll just get impatient and try to do something to end it. Do you get that sense? Or does he just not care? Is he so locked in with the Israeli position?
I mean, it's very hard to know. Obviously, I think there was a lot of concern based on Trump's picks for his various cabinet appointments, many of whom are extremely anti-Palestine, very pro-Israel. Obviously, people like Mike Huckabee, who denies the idea of the existence of a state of the existence of the Palestinians, and Ali Stefanik for UN ambassador. At the same time, what I've heard is these were selections made to appease major donors, people like Miriam Adelson, who's provided hundreds of millions of dollars to both this recent campaign and Trump's previous campaigns, who very much supports Israel annexing the West Bank. But at the same time, there are also, we know that Trump fancies himself the ultimate deal maker, that he sees it as his right to win a Nobel Peace Prize, the same way President Obama and President Carter did, and some kind of resolution to the conflict would perhaps justify him winning a peace prize if it was in fact a true resolution. I know he has his eye on Israeli-Saudi normalization, and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia has been very clear that that will not happen without the establishment of a state of Palestine, although I think he may have been staking out that position. I don't know that he will necessarily adhere to that. He may be willing to be satisfied by some sort of nominal process, something similar to Oslo, where neither Israel nor the United States has any intention to actually make progress towards the establishment of a state of Palestine, but that the Saudis would be able to say that they made some progress there.
And Trump has also spoken about Gaza as a prime real estate territory, I guess.
Exactly.
His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, would that be something that would suggest he would go along with what the Israelis want to do, or would it be something that he could sell as a way of helping Palestinians as well?
I mean, you're not wrong that he has described Gaza in those terms, as has Jared Kushner. Again, it's just very hard to know like what exactly his plans are there. I think, you know, what we can be sure of is that Trump is not interested in being seen as weak, the way Biden was seen as just bowing to Netanyahu and giving him whatever he wanted, even when he repeatedly broke these so-called red lines that Biden tried to establish. And so I don't think we're going to see Netanyahu being able to push Trump around the same way he could push Biden around. But that being said, I also don't think that Trump has any sort of commitment to the fate of Palestinians, except insofar as it's a means for him to sort of enhance his own reputation again as this deal maker and peacemaker. I mean, it is encouraging that he has used language around the notion of no new wars, keeping the U.S. out of unnecessary wars, you know, this notion of the American people are tired of wars and want peace. I mean, these are encouraging things for him to say. And I think the reason he says them is because they resonate with many Americans who have seen unnecessary and costly wars, especially in the Middle East. I just hope that he actually implements policies that would facilitate less military engagement and, you know, no getting dragged into a war with Iran, for example, which we know Netanyahu would very much want the United States to fight Iran on Israel's behalf.
Yeah, it seems like Trump is more interested in American companies selling weapons to make money than he is in actually going to war. But we'll see.
Exactly, right. I think Mohammed bin Salman made some eye-popping commitment of $600 billion in investments to the United States, which is, to my understanding, larger than the entire PIF fund that Saudi controls. So it's I think he was perhaps just trying to get Trump's attention. But, you know, we know that the Saudi, the Al Saud and the Trump family have very close ties. And it seems kind of crazy to expect the House of Saud to be an advocate for justice. But I hope that whether it's the UAE or the Saudis, that they may be able to convince Trump that blindly supporting Israeli aggression, whether it's in Lebanon or in Syria or perhaps against Jordan and certainly against the Palestinians, is not in U.S. interests in the long run.
And anything else you'd like to add to what you said?
I mean, I very much hope that the ceasefire lasts. Obviously, I am not optimistic about that, but I very desperately hope it does. But I do worry a little bit about the lack, you know, that as the world's attention shifts, and obviously Trump himself loves being the center of attention and is already pursuing lots of different executive orders that are drawing a lot of media attention, that people won't necessarily continue to pay attention to what's happening, even though we know there have already been significant violations of the ceasefire in Gaza, in to say nothing of the escalation of and killing of Palestinians in the West Bank. So while I hope the ceasefire holds, I also worry about people no longer paying attention to what's happening there.
Yeah, it seems like every day we hear the UN Secretary General or some UN official talk about the horrible things that are happening. And, you know, I think they're obligated to make those statements, and I'm sure they sincerely believe in what they're saying. But, you know, the UN is kind of ineffectual when it comes to actually stopping it.
Certainly. And we know that Trump is no particular champion of the UN and is already talking about, you know, reforming. I imagine we'll pull out of the UN Human Rights Council as he did before, maybe withdraw U.S. funding for the UN. So, yeah, I don't imagine the UN will be made more effective under a Trump presidency.
That was Anel Shaleen of the Quincy Institute speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director for Oregon Arts Watch, to discuss some of the latest stories from the arts world. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. So we've got a few stories to touch on today. First one here, it's called Better Together, Oregon Arts Commission Cultural Trust Aim for a Merger. These are some of the big deal organizations in the state. Can you talk me through what they do and what this merger would mean?
Lots of news this week. This is a real nuts and bolts story that's actually a really big deal. It could easily fly under the radar, but it's important to pay attention to it. So right now, there's the Oregon Cultural Trust and the Oregon Arts Commission. They're two separate state agencies. A lot of people aren't even aware that they're two completely different state agencies with their own boards, because there's some overlap. And they would, in effect, this new plan is that they would both dissolve and form a new combined state agency by 2027. It would be a new state agency that would be semi-independent, which is very important because there are advantages where this new agency could be more efficient. It will be independent. It will have a more streamlined approach. And that way it can have an increased impact where it can really make a difference. Right now they have two bills before the Oregon legislature for the 2025 session that will make this a possibility, hoping that it goes through. And the big takeaways for this is that it will mean the more efficient form of government is, and who doesn't like that, is that the independents will mean that they will be able to make progress more quickly, because right now they're housed under Business Oregon, which is really great to work with. They're supportive, but it's a big agency, and these are two smaller agencies among many. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and there's a lot of a very long approval process. So becoming independent means that they will be able to make a lot of their own decisions and be able to make progress faster. So that will affect all the entire Oregon arts and cultural community. It would help all of us to be able to work more efficiently. They're considering their model to be the Oregon Office of Film and Video that also works similarly. I will mention that Sean Andrews, who's the chair of the Oregon Cultural Trust Board, he mentions that Oregon is number one in the nation in per capita for individual arts and culture support for individual giving, but it's number 39 in state support. So there's a real disconnect there. And part of the idea is that this new agency will be able to serve the community better.
So the bills to merge these two organizations are before the Oregon legislature right now. If they pass, how would it impact their funding and the support that they're able to provide? Because they are similar organizations, but they are still slightly different. Like, they haven't merged up until this point.
That's a really good question. And part of one of the very important things to understand is that they are very carefully considering all of their various funding sources and all of their ways that they distribute funds and all of their programs, and they want to make sure that they carry all of those forward into the new agency so that there will be stability among the arts and culture community, which is really important. This actually is a real plus to have these improvements. I would just say that this new plan just makes a lot of sense. A lot of people aren't even aware that there are these two separate agencies because they have so much overlap. And they were created, you know, for different reasons, which it makes sense. But it's also time that this is sort of the natural evolution of what should happen. It kind of seems that all of this came about kind of quickly this past year. The two boards voted unanimously in May and June to explore this possibility, and they formed a new joint committee to explore this. But the foundation had been laid over several years. They have been looking at feasibility studies to do this, how the new government structure would work. So they've done a lot of work ahead of time. And they're really hoping to look at what could possibly be any hurdles and address those. For instance, the Oregon Cultural Trust has very important branding because they raise a lot of funds. You know, the donors give to the Oregon Cultural Tax Credit, and so they want to maintain that branding look. So there are considerations, very important considerations, that they need to address to make this possible.
And if it passes, this transition would happen in 2027, is that right?
Yeah, they have a framework in place, sort of a timeline, what they hope to do when. I guess there's always a question of what will happen in the legislature. We know that a lot of times they have a lot of bills that they don't get to. These two bills that are a part of this plan are two of at least 3,000 in front of the legislature for this session. So, you know, who knows if they will get to it. But it makes a lot of sense that this will be a new, efficient way of governing. And so who doesn't like that?
Well, on the subject of government funding for the arts, another story in Oregon Arts Watch recently is this one. It's called IFCC Looking to Renew, Make Its Grant and Artist Residency Program Permanent. That's the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland, which started with some pandemic era funding to support artists here, and it's now expanding. Can you tell me about that?
They have this grant and residency program, which, as you mentioned, was part of this short-term pandemic relief funding. It was started in 2022. And so the bigger story here is that now that they will make this permanent, but this also offers a really solid way forward to transform the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center into a center for Black arts and culture. The IFCC was originally built in 1910 as a firehouse, and it's not seismically sound to withstand earthquakes. So right now they're looking at the possibility of significant renovation and expansion, which is exciting. The IFCC has had different oversight over the years. Sometimes it's fallen into disrepair. So this marks some sure footing for some exciting changes that can really benefit the Black community. It's funded by the City of Portland and the 1803 Fund, which is a Black-led philanthropic organization working to revitalize Portland's Black culture. So they're making a big impact there.
They've funded a whole bunch of different artist residencies for Black artists in Portland, being able to use that space for any number of projects.
Yeah, and it gives that space a real purpose. It's overseen by Friends of IFCC, which is sort of the nonprofit that oversees it. So it's nice that it's really settling into something substantial. It hasn't had a focus for a few years, so this really gives it something to build on.
Well, you mentioned that renovations might be in their future. That's something that they're looking at. But speaking of renovations and renovations that are in progress, there's another story I wanted to ask you about. It's called At the Portland Art Museum, a new gallery for Black art and expression is in the making. This is, of course, having to do with PAM's sort of facelift overhaul and devoting some new space to Black art specifically. Tell me about this one.
When the Portland Art Museum opens its transformed spaces later this year, it has undergone a multi-year remodel. So I think we're all excited to see what that will be like. So when it reopens, a new Black Art and Experiences Gallery will debut. And funding for this new gallery also came from the 1803 Fund, which is also supporting the changes at IFCC. So the fund is really having a substantial impact in elevating Black arts and culture in Portland. It's exciting stuff.
And what do we know about what this new space will be like at the Portland Art Museum?
Well, later this year, they have four different exhibits planned. So it will be dedicated to Black arts and culture. The new exhibits will be able to display some of the items that the Portland Art Museum already has in its collection. When it opens later this year, it will feature four exhibits. It'll feature Tenderhead, a solo exhibition that features new works, and a site-specific installation by Portland artist Lisa Jarrett. It will have an exhibition of prints by Black artists that is drawn from the Portland Art Museum's collection. It will have a video installation by Micheline Thomas, and it will have a series of performances with artists Noah Beckham, Miles Greenberg, and Bridget Hickey. So they have a lot of exciting things that the Portland, it really makes the Portland Art Museum more Portland-centric, really offering visual art and performance and a variety of artwork that is based here in Portland and that really serves the community. It's terrific for us to be able to look at artwork from around the world, but it's also really important that it reflect the community. So this means a substantial change for the Portland Art Museum, I would say. And kudos to the 1803 Fund for making this possible.
Also, slight footnote in that article that the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, PICA, just won a big grant from the Warhol Foundation as well.
Yeah, they won a $120,000 grant, which makes a lot of things possible there. They were one of only 47 arts organizations across the country and a couple of international groups to receive this funding. So it was one of the largest in this round of Warhol grants, and I'm sure that they will put that to some exciting use.
I'm wondering, Laura, are there things that folks at home should be looking out for in the arts world in the coming days, in the coming weeks, in the coming months, things that are on your radar?
Well, definitely a lot of the gosh, a lot of the expansion plans. I'm really impressed with just how the arts community has been resilient since the pandemic to move forward and think big and make changes. I just got word this morning that they're looking to build a whole new major art center in Bend, for instance. So I'm excited to see what that might look like. They actually don't have anything there now, even though it's been, the population there has grown substantially in recent years. So they used to have the auditorium at Bend High School, but it unexpectedly had to be demolished last year because of it wasn't seismically sound. It wasn't structurally sound. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing all of the different expansion and growth plans that are in the works.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find out more about the stories that we talked about or generally about Oregon Arts Watch?
You can read all of the arts news at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Laura, thank you so much for stopping by KBOO News in Depth today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
That was Laura Grimes, the Executive Director for Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest stories to come out of that publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea.
To KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the